This is another DAM podcast about digital asset management. I'm Henrik de Gior. Today you'll hear a recording of Rebecca Schneider of Avenue CX talking about tagging and empathy from the Insight Exchange Network's Digital Asset Management Practitioners Summit in New York City on January 24th, 2019. Enjoy.
Today, I'd like to explore empathy and how we can represent empathy in our asset tagging. This is a very open discussion. This is an exploration. This is not set in stone. This is based on my thoughts and my ideas as I was talking, doing some research and talking with others about this. So if you have any questions or comments, you know, during the presentation, please feel free to speak up. So this is me. I, too, am of the librarian clan. So I've been working a lot with taxonomies and metadata throughout my career. I work a lot in sales enablement as well as personalization and omnichannel through my company, Avenue CX. So as Dan mentioned, this started off with a comment that I made about the future of DAM. I'd like to see content represented more empathetically. And so I thought, and then everybody sagely nodded, and we went on with our panel discussion, and the conference ended. And then Sean contacted me and asked me if I wanted to come and speak again. And I thought, well, you know, I'm kind of interested in this whole tagging and empathy thing. You know, what do you think? And so we talked about it. And he said, sure, but let's put that together. And then I realized, dang, now I actually have to put something together about this stuff and I have to speak about it. So after much head scratching and talking with people and talking with other experts, this is what I put together. So again, this is an exploration. Please feel free to contribute. So on empathy. Okay, first I'm going to tell you a story. And it sort of relates to empathy in a way because empathy is about, you know, understanding what other people are feeling. So I suffer from tinnitus, which is a ringing in the ears that I've had for about the last 25 years. I'm mostly deaf in one ear because of it. Most of my friends know about it, though they kind of forget about it. I rearrange people around the dinner table. I move around in a room in a different way, and I'll sit in a certain way in order to, based on the acoustics of the room. I use a white noise generator and all that fun stuff. So, and then what I hear is similar to what I'm going to attempt to play for you. And I don't, it's in my head. It's literally in my head. I'm not crazy, at least I don't think so. Okay, so actually it's a little bit tonally lower than that, but that's fairly close. And it changes in tonal value based on air pressure. And so I really know when it's raining out. I'm like a human barometer at this point. So at any rate, so this is, you know, it's one of those things I deal with, no big deal. But then recently a friend of mine had an ear infection and got some tinnitus, you know, temporarily. I said, go to the doctor, it'll be fine, but you know, you should go to the doctor. And he was complaining about it, and he said, gosh, I've got a migraine, I can't work, this is awful, I can't believe this. And I said, welcome to my world, bucko. I just like, I felt badly for him, and I felt, you know, it's like, yes, I literally hear what you're hearing. And so this is sort of my story about empathy and having others experience what I experience on a daily basis. So let's talk a little bit about empathy. So there's, okay, and this is, of course, the definition slide that we all have to put in our presentations. So there are basically three types of empathy. There is cognitive, so that's emotional recognition, and the perception and accurate identification of the what's called the feeling states of others. And then there's emotional, so that's the affective empathy, where you're mirroring someone else's feelings. And then there's compassionate empathy, which is feelings of sympathy, concern, and compassion for another. This is typically the most desirable type of empathy. And, you know, out there, this is really what you want people to feel. So, in short, it's being able to walk in another person's shoes no matter how much those four-inch heels hurt you. This is a quote that I found on another presentation that I thought was great. And I also want to point out that empathy is a skill that can be learned. It's one of the building blocks of social intelligence, or what's called emotional quotient. And for many people, empathy is the key part of their personal and professional success. Being empathetic often leads to a more successful social and professional interactions. So that's great, but what does that mean for a brand? What does that mean for an organization? So why empathy? So from a brand and marketing perspective, it creates a distinctive content experience. It increases the brand's loyalty when you have that type of interaction, and it also increases consumer interest. So I have this quote from Ann Handley that says, even when you are marketing to your entire audience or customer base, you are simply speaking to a single human at any given time. So, and also a few numbers, because I tend to be a numbers person and I find these interesting. So based on my research, YouTube stats show that 70% of millennials users watched YouTube to learn how to do something new this last year, and that 39% of them said an online video had helped to change their perspective. It helped them empathize. And the other piece that I found very interesting, and this was a study by Hoppus Group, meaningful brands, which means kind of more empathetic, sort of, you know, really engaging with their audience, have outperformed in the stock market by 206% over a 10-year period. What I find super interesting is that in the same study, people said people wouldn't care if 74% of the brands they use just went away. They wouldn't care. So that brand loyalty is super key. So I wanted to show you a few examples that I've found over the years that kind of, you know, are examples of empathy and how it's used. So this first is a women's clothing company called M.M. LaFleur. They are primarily online, but they do have pop-ups, and I think one's currently in Boston right now. And this is a set of images and text, and it relates compelling stories from individuals. They're biographies with portrait images and text to tell a person's story. They explored a woman's ups and downs, successes, encounters, and so on. So what's the payoff here? Why would you have this on a woman's clothing website? You want them to buy clothing. It represents a clothing store that's about more than just clothing. But it also helps to sell a product at the bottom of a bio, and it displays outfits relate that the person has worn throughout all the images that you've seen. And so they'll provide, did you like her look, and et cetera, et cetera. So, and these stories are, this is full text. This is long copy. This is a lot of copy and a lot of imagery associated with it. This is just sort of like the top part of it. The next example is a nonprofit. So this is from the National Autistic Society. And this is very interesting. This is a self-directed virtual reality experience where you go, essentially, you're a character in a mall, and you go through and you experience stimuli like an autistic person would. So there's lots of flashes, lots of things that you would see. Like if you make it through the entire thing without with your eyes, you know, freaking out a little bit, I'd be surprised. There's also an accompanying walkthrough video. So if you don't do the 360, which you can, you know, use your mouse and go through different areas and stuff like that. But there's also a walkthrough experience. So this experiential content helps to create awareness for a condition at a level that could not be communicated in text or images. Okay, this is one you probably, many of you recognize. This is Misty Copeland in the Under Armour video. So where Misty Copeland performs ballet while a voice reads her rejection letters. And so this is all about, because she's now the principal dancer at the American Ballet Theater. And it just, you know, people like an underdog. They like the to be associated with a brand that is associated with a person who, through perseverance and grit, got where she wanted to go. Okay. So next I want to talk about, you know, I showed you some examples. And one of the things I ran into a lot was that these were not one-offs, but they were very campaign-focused. There's nothing wrong with that, but, you know, how do you scale that up over sort of a long, you know, larger numbers of assets and a more, you know, impactful content experience? So part of that is context. So when you're talking about culture or income, education, ethnicity, social norms, et cetera, these are all the contexts within which we live. And so for empathetic content to be successful, we need to put our content in context with itself and with the target audience. And I won't go into details of each of these right now, but just keep these in mind as I go through the next couple of slides. Because if you don't take your context into consideration, your efforts to utilize empathy and content can backfire. So here's a few examples of what I call context gone awry. So the first off is a what was called creepy personalization or overly pushed content can, you know, is an example of backfiring. This example where a woman's dad is in assisted living and he receives a Christmas basket from the local mortuary. Personalization used in tandem with empathy needs to be carefully planned or will wreak havoc with a brand's standing. And this is another famous one. It's a little bit older, but I felt it was within the context of big data, still appropriate. So here, a company, Target, used a massive collection of big data to determine if a woman was pregnant or not. Based on this data, the company sent out targeted mailers to a pregnant teen focusing on baby products, baby preparation, things like that, even before her father was informed of the pregnancy. This type of interaction can make people feel like they have a lack of control over their data and markedly reduces any ability to create an empathetic experience. So we all have different perceptions, and one image can have multiple interpretations. So what is that thing is informed by who we are as individuals, as well as members of different groups, family, work, ethnic, etc. And this is the famous duck and bunny, and then a lovely Rorschach block test. Yet images can tell impactful stories. On the left, New York celebrates the surrender of Japan at the end of World War II, this is a fairly famous image. And a quote with this image that I found was, "They threw anything and kissed anybody in Times Square." On the right, gold medalist Tommy Smith and bronze medalist, John Carlos showing the race fist on the podium after the 200-meter race on the 1968 Summer Olympics, protesting racial discrimination. Both wear Olympic Project for Human Rights badges. Peter Norman from Australia wears the same badge in solidarity with Smith and Carlos. So these images have an impact based on who you are and the time period and their context. And sometimes it's not what you meant, it's what's perceived. The best of intentions can go wrong. Attempts to incorporate events into a brand story can backfire. On the left, Aisha Evans during protests against police brutality in Baton Rouge. This image went viral and resonated with many. On the right, which is kind of hard to tell, I was taking a still off the video. On the right, Kendall Jenner in a Pepsi ad that was seen as tone deaf and playing fast and loose with protest imagery. And I also found Pepsi's response to the backlash of this particular ad. They say, "Pepsi was trying to protect a global message of unity, peace, and understanding. Clearly, we missed the mark and we apologize. We did not intend to make light of any serious issue." A similar example, for example, would be the Dolce & Gabbana video advertisements in China, which were widely seen as racist and pandering to old stereotypes. So I've showed you sort of like the good and the bad and what could happen. And talking about tagging empathy and where do you start? How do you even attempt to tag for empathy? And I, you know, after talking with people, I'm thinking about this a lot. Again, I'm coming back to that context of, you know, the culture. What is your way of life? And all of this, sorry, let me back up. And all of this is particularly important for global brands, but it can apply to all brands. So the way of life, you know, which can differ, for example, in the same country. I'm originally from the Midwest. I'm from Wisconsin, if you can't tell from my accent. But I have been living on the East Coast for 20 years, and I can certainly attest to the cultural differences. I still use my turning signal. All my other colleagues in New England think it's a sign of weakness when you use your turning signal. And I've just gotten used to it, and after 20 years, I still use my turning signal. And then you think about education. Education level is key here, as well as associations with college or university experiences, especially in sports. Go Badgers. Okay. For income, you know, for certain brands, understanding income is important, as well as how it's associated as your perception of what you're wearing. Is it cool? Is it trendy? Or is it exclusive? Or if for other people, is it affordable? Ethnicity. So where do you feel at home? Who are your people? You know, this can be small or large groups, and they can't, you know, they might not even be readily identifiable groups. So as I mentioned, I am of the Liberian clan and I have Liberian clan friends, but then I was graciously accepted into another clan who I call the Smith clan, which has a lot of former Smith graduates in it, and they were kind enough to take me in. So, you know, those affect your context. And also social norms. What is socially acceptable to you? And again, this could vary widely within a group or a geographic area as well. So keeping all this context in mind, let's talk about metadata, which I know we all love to talk about. So we're talking about representing content. We have what I'm calling standard metadata. So this is, you know, your technical metadata, the technical details of an image or a video, descriptive metadata, such as the creator, keywords, controlled vocabulary or not, captions, titles, etc., and then administrative metadata, so licensing, copyright, workflow, approval, and so forth. So that's standard, but what about the sympathy stuff? So for empathy, I'd like to think in terms of an empathy map, which you'll see to the right here, and really focus on who is the user and his or her context. So the audience. So typically in personalization, you focus on segments or personas, or sometimes both, but you typically one or the other. So a segment is a division of the market or population into subgroups. So segments are like geographic, demographic, use of the product, level of expertise, and so forth. A persona is essentially a fictional character or an archetype, which are created based on research in order to represent different user types that might use your service or product or brand in a certain way. This is, you know, Susie from the suburbs and, you know, Rebecca from the farm, et cetera, et cetera. So these are, you know, different, they're not specific people, but they're archetypes, they're representative. So the next is the communication goal. What are you trying to communicate? What does the company or brand want to communicate? And then also the emotional mindset. So what's the mindset of the user as they go to a particular website? For example, in the retail context, it means, you know, I just need validation on what I'm going to buy. I want to be first or an early adopter. Please see the people lining up at the Apple store, or buy and be done with it. Whereas if you're on a, you know, if you're applying for, you know, unemployment benefits, you have an entirely different mindset. So you need to consider that as you're thinking about setting up your structures. So by incorporating these aspects into your metadata and your tagging strategy allows you to deliver empathetic content to specific audiences. So how do you develop that? So I was like, put yourself in their shoes. Like we talked about earlier, when you're focusing on more, a lot of researchers focus on quantitative research, which is not bad or awful, but instead focus on qualitative. Walk the customer journeys that you've created for your content journeys. Actually go through those particular steps. Feel how it goes to go through them. Relay customer stories. Use qualitative success measures, sentiment measures, focus groups, in-depth interviews, and so forth. Another big one is customer support feedback. You know, your call centers, I'm sure they have loads of stories to tell you about, you know, either the, you know, why people call, what do they need help with? And then sales team input. So this is for B2Bs and B2Cs. So you have your point of sale in a retail context, you know, it's people who are on the floor selling something, you know, working with customers, but you also have in a B2B context, you have your direct sales force as well as your channels or the distributors that you work through, who also can relay back those stories and that kind of qualitative input. So all this sounds great, but what are their potential roadblocks? So here, the audience definitions can change, you know, necessitating, you know, additional items, just additional things you need to be thinking about. Also, new personas or segments are added, requiring additional tagging on top of new content. Or, you know, and also, you know, the question is, are your personas up to date? So a lot of times, a lot of companies will create a set of personas and then they'll never be updated, which is not a good idea. So just check that your personas are up to date, that you have the right kind of personas that you need. Also, customer journeys are added or altered, you know, again, requiring additional tags or re-tagging. And a lot of this can seem kind of overwhelming. But it, you know, these things that you have to think about before you sort of start down this particular path. And for a lot of brands, you know, many of whom are here today, the sheer number of objects that have to be tagged in order to create an ongoing engaging experience, you know, that really focuses on empathy as opposed to a singular campaign. So those are some of the larger issues that, you know, may be too burdensome to even to attempt, honestly, when I was thinking about this. So here are some final thoughts. Boy, I'm just going right through this. See, I'm going to get you guys there no matter what. So we can tag with empathy in mind. You can do that. You can create the structures for it. But proceed with caution. And remember to identify your audience and their context. These are the things that require a lot of work on the front end, but may really, really pay off in the final analysis. I have, again, this is just some ideas and exploration that I've had. I have not done this with any of my clients. And if you knew anybody who'd be interested in doing this kind of thing, just let me know. But anyway, this is really a start of a conversation that I would like to have sort of ongoing. I'm talking with additional like behavioral scientists and such about this type of interaction. And this is just essentially, this is a side interest of mine. I don't use it in my daily work, but I find it interesting. So, any comments or questions or scathing rebuttal? Or do y'all just want to have a cocktail? Anyone? Yes.
This was great. It's really helpful. Right now, my organization is in the process of redoing their taxonomy and doing their retroactive keywording for the majority of the archive. And the assets that we will be cataloging or tagging deal with people in developing countries, indigenous people, and also using a particular type of language that speaks about climate change issues. And
right.
So as an organization that deals with different nations and different cultures, it's a good reminder for me that we need to be sensitive about how we describe our assets that will be disseminated to the whole.
Absolutely. Yeah. I used to, librarian reference. I used to manage the library for United States Agency for International Development. Mm-hmm. And we worked a lot with their publications team and a lot with their archive of all the research that USAID would put out. And there's the taxonomy. Yes, I have it printed out. It's like 2 inches thick of their, that included the role length of SARS, which is no longer available. And thinking about that in terms of what, how people perceive things, particularly from a non-European, non-American perspective is really important. People don't think that way. And also, one interesting thing I did run into, and this is a bit of a side comment, that even the USAID thesaurus itself was affected based on which administration was in power.
Our funding's been cut.
Well, yeah. And there were certain terms we weren't allowed to use based on the administration.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. It's just one of those. You just keep the other. You know, you just keep them, you know, in a file, waiting until you know the next administration comes in. It's fine.
I really love this. I practice this at my position, and something that I've noticed is when I'm into a taxonomy that was created, and I was disappointed by it. I thought a lot of it was not thoughtful. And by removing some of the things that I didn't like, I noticed that I was able to change the actual vocabulary that my leadership was using. So I'm slowly changing the culture of my organization and the way we are looking at marketing because, you know, there are students. Why would we hate them in this particular way? And so it's been, I really support this and I love this and want to talk more about it. I'm here for it.
Words have power.
And yeah, they really do. So thank you.
Thanks. Anyone else? Okay. Well. A little bit early, but I guess that's okay, Sean?
Yeah.
Okay. So thank you for staying through this presentation. And if you have any questions or input, or indeed, seriously, I'm looking for it, scathing rebuttal, do let me know. So thank you for your time.
If you enjoyed this talk and want to hear more about the Insight Exchange Network's DAM Practitioners Summit, happening in January 2020 in New York City, along with a discount code, links to register, and more details, visit the show notes at anotherdampodcast.com. Thanks again.